This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest on this episode is Paul Berg. Paul, it's good to have you with us again today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
And Paul, we want to start by picking up on some of the themes we had the first time, where we really got to know you as a person. But you talked about your time in the military and how being very observant and able to write up those observations made you very useful in other settings, such as in the Dakotas or in Alaska, working with Native education programs. And what we're doing some with the Warrior Writers interviewees in these last interviews is talking about what are the lessons that you learned in war that you can take to the world now.
Exactly.
And some of those lessons might help us either stay out of war or conduct these inevitable wars with a little less violence, or avoid them altogether if they're not these matters of vanity. I think we got talking on one of the last shows about war as vanity at times, and Vietnam was a bit of that. Paul.
Yes.
Where would you like to start on that, in that mix of lessons you've learned and how you've applied them, and what you can do from that very harrowing experience that you had sending bombers out to blow things up?
I think where I would begin is at age 5 and becoming very, very ill and having to lay in bed for 9 months.
Yes.
Without knowing how to read. There was no television back then. Grandma moved in. My parents and grandma read books to me, and I had picture books and birds, the bird feeder. But I learned, it took a tremendous price, because I was very slow when I eventually got to first grade. It took me a long time to learn the alphabet and the sounds. And I was very disappointed to learn I was not a very smart student in school, but it there was a gift also. I could hyper focus. I could hyper concentrate. Mm-hmm. That wasn't terribly important in school until probably late middle school, junior high, I should say, and probably in high school, where I eventually kind of caught up and was a B student, you know, solid B student. But I think I learned to focus, hyper focus, and stay on becoming hypervigilant early on. I think that was a gift I didn't realize at the time.
Right, right. And I'm just kind of taken by you're still wearing the label of a B student. That still has resonance in your life story.
Well, yes, you know, a B student, you got your B because you worked at it.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a form of intelligence also. Hard work is intelligence.
Yeah, I agree.
And, yeah, and but it's a different story than a B has today.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you're telling us a story from 70 years ago.
65 years ago, 65. A B in a high school course meant a B.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, and college was still that way 45 years ago when I was attending.
Yeah.
You know, it also, you know, when I listen to that sort of thing, and of course I've heard other people say that, you know, we have this way of measuring full intelligence by the grades we get in school.
Right.
And I love the way, in my mind, when I'm listening to you, that flies in the face of those kind of standards that we use to measure how smart people are, because your experiences in life are far beyond B, you know what I mean? Like way beyond B in the realm of your time in the war, in the realm of your time lying in bed, for goodness sakes, you know, the things that go through your head, the things that you wonder about for your future, the thing, I mean, those are the things that really pick us apart and we have to put ourselves back together. And that is a really important thing to have to do. You know?
Yes, indeed. And it's a cultural concept also in the Western, especially American point of view about intelligence. Intelligence is like what you have. We even give a number to it. Your IQ is 120 or your IQ is 130.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you go to Asian education systems, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, for example, intelligence is defined more or less by what you do.
Yes.
not just what you have, it's how
Yeah.
you act and what you do. So I tend to identify more with the Asian view of intelligence. Intelligence is what you
Ah,
do,
yes.
not just what you have.
Yes. And it's a way of living, you know. The grades they give us is like when we learn things in school, it's almost like we're really being graded for retaining information, right? The information is not even ours because we got it from books or whatever. When you this life that you live, that's your, that's
Right,
yours,
you
that's
own
your
it.
information, you know? And I love that.
So you wanted to start telling how what you've learned from your life experience and your military experience, how you've taken that later in life, and that's why we got started with you at 5 years old
Yes.
in bed for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, in where should I continue with the military experience, naval intelligence?
Continue with what are you doing now, and walk us back. What
Okay.
are you doing now, and walk us back to how those experience shape what you're doing now. May does that work
Well,
for you?
yes, it does. I would say today I'm still engaged in a war. In Alaska today, there's a cultural war taking place.
Okay.
It's a real war. There are casualties. Alaska has become the most dangerous state according to FBI statistics. I have a teacher friend who's lost 65 students to violent death, mostly suicide. There are villages in Alaska where half the boys survive till th past 30. In other words, half of them die in their teens and 20s.
Wow.
In the two village, three villages that I studied over a 7 year period, the cause of death was number one, suicide, bizarre accident, gone missing, alcohol and drugs, and homicide. But these are just the actual physical causes of death.
Right.
Real causes of death were a much deeper process.
Yes.
And so it's a cultural war that began 500 years ago when Columbus came to the island of Hispaniola and started the conflict with the local native people.
The town
And
of.
it's continued till the present time. The last battles, I guess, in this 500-year-old war are being fought in Alaska today. And I continue it. I consider it to be a continuation of the war I got involved with 50 years ago. In that sense, we're still involved in the conflict today. And I think the skills I learned in Navy intelligence during the Vietnam War are very, very useful today, except now, not in taking lives, but in trying to preserve lives, save lives, bring about peace between the warring factions, if you will. So that's more or less what my wife and I do at this point in our life. And that's why we're in Alaska last week, and we'll be up there again in several more days.
Okay.
Let's take a break with Lee Greenwood's Home to Alaska.
There's a mountaintop that's protected by the snow. And when I need some time alone, it's a place where I can go. 'Cause I share my dreams with the caribou and the whisper of the wind. And I long to be in Glacier Bay again. I wanna go home. Alaska, where the eagles fly across the golden sky. I wanna go home to Alaska, 'cause the northern lights are in my woman's eyes. Giant grizzly the salmon as they run, and all of nature's wonders in the 7 months of sun. I'd seen the mighty Yukon as it races to the sea, and heard the barking of the huskies calling me. I wanna go home to Alaska, where the eagles fly across the golden sky. I wanna go home to Alaska, 'cause the northern lights are in my woman's eyes. Oh, and though the tropic sun can turn my skin to golden brown, it's the ring that's on my hand that keeps me warm. I wanna go home to Alaska, where the eagles fly across the golden sky. I wanna go home to Alaska, where the north lights are in my woman's eyes, 'cause the northern lights are in my woman's eyes.
This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest today is Paul Berg. Paul is sharing with us lessons from the war over education for Native youth in Alaska. This show may be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org. What are you counting? What are you reporting now? What are you?
What am I reporting now? Well, for I give you an example of we just attended a summit meeting in Alaska where 40 educators, historians, educational administrators, a few bureaucrats were invited to address the problem in Alaskan education. How do we teach Alaska studies? How do we teach Alaska history more appropriately? We're failing to do it properly. There, the main concern they brought up, again, dealing with the fact that Alaska has these very negative statistics that are concentrated in the indigenous community. The most damaging statistics are found in the rural villages. And they, part of the reason they wanted to get people together to problem solve is that Alaska will bring in probably 600 teachers a year and school administrators from the lower 48. Most of them go into the villages. They stay from 1 to 3 years. They don't know anything about Alaska history, don't know anything about Alaska cultures, yet they end up teaching Alaska history at the high school level because it's required of the state. The state requires an Alaska Studies Alaska History course. So we have people who are unqualified to teach it, teaching it. What I brought up at the meeting, and the reason they brought us all the way from upstate New York, because we have been working on an Alaska history book from the indigenous perspective.
Nice.
We added the dimension, and they wanted us to talk about this, that not only are do we have teachers who are not qualified to teach Alaska history because they do not know it, but the standard history that's being taught is distorted. It's very incomplete. It's the history that's written by the new arrivals, the dominant culture people.
Yes.
The native history, the indigenous history, is either underreported or ignored. And it's causing, it's a disaster to do that. We can't confront the problems we have today unless we confront the issues of yesterday and the issues of today also, honestly. In other words, confront and deal with our history. And some of it is very, very unpleasant. One example being that when Alaska was purchased, if you will, in 1867 from Russia, the Russians insisted that native citizenship be part of the deal. Alexander II was adamant that Alaska Natives would be incorporated into the United States either as direct citizens or have a route to access citizenship in the near term. And as far as we know, when he sold Alaska to the United States, there were between 10 and 12,000 Alaska Natives who held citizenship in the Russian Empire. They held actual citizenship. So he was very aware of this. Within 3 days of the sale, all Alaska Natives were declared to be non-citizens. And that was just one of many examples. And that's not generally known or included in the Alaska history books. By the way, what does that mean? That means he lost his civil rights. Could not legally own land, did not have title to land, could not stake a mining claim, could not partake in the gold rushes that came about, could not, in the early phases, for at least 20 years, appear in court against a white man, could not vote, could not hold office. So it was, that is just one aspect of that history that is underreported or totally not reported.
And I certainly so had never heard
I was bringing this up to the group and saying, we've got, not only do we have to teach, provide materials to these teachers who are unqualified to teach, but it has to be an accurate history where we're really dealing with our past and we're confronting some of the not too happy events in our past and events that are causing this crime rate and the suicide rate today.
That's right.
And that was, it was well received. We were well received.
That's great.
So as you prepare these materials, you're working on a book, right?
Yes.
So the book is nearly done.
Yes.
Tell us about the book and tell us about how you intend for teachers to appropriate that book with Native students and what those, what kinds of relationships can actually make it, make the information, make the knowledge live?
Well, first of all, the book that we wrote was that we did not write it as a high school textbook. We wrote it in the genre of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee,
okay,
by Dee Brown, which was published in 1971 and has never been out of print since that time. And of course, what he did is he analyzed the years from 1860 to 1890, a mere 30-year period. But he analyzed the wars, the Indian Wars of the West, but from the indigenous perspective.
Yes.
And then it's also of the same genre as Killers of the Flower Moon.
Ah, yes, okay.
And what we were doing is analyzing, presenting history, Alaska history, from aspects of the history that are very underreported or not reported. And one example being the denial of citizenship, despite the purchasing agreement, including the guarantee of citizenship for Alaska Natives. Another aspect of this is for 2.5 generations, Indigenous children in the bush were taken away from the families and sent to boarding schools.
Mm.
The ending of that program came about 1976. And it's done enormous damage to the cultures, to the individuals, to the people of rural Alaska. One of the damages that it did is these people were not raised in families. They were raised in institutions.
Yes, yes.
When
yes.
they married, they did not have family, the culture of family life as part of their consciousness. They did not know how to be good husbands. They did not know how to be good wives. And believe me, they had no idea how to raise teenagers. Family, 2 or 3 generations since 1976, of families that have just fallen apart because family culture has been subverted.
Right. When did they start being sent to the boarding schools?
1890s.
So it was an 86-year.
Yeah, it was a gradual process. It changed from year to year to year. By the early 1860s, the 1960s, the state of Alaska was putting elementary schools, K through eight, or one through eight, in the villages. And it was very rare by late 60s for children who were under 12 or 13 or 14 to be sent out of the villages. But 14 to 18 year olds were still taken out until 1976. So it changed over time, year to year. And also in the research we did and the interviews we did, we found that some of these boarding schools were rather well run. And some of them were absolutely terrible, absolutely horrifically terrible, filled with abuse. And we talked to students who came from dysfunctional families who were very happy to go to St. Mary's, for example, because the sisters and the nuns and the priests and the brothers there were very kind. Now, they didn't include much Native culture, but they were decent people.
Yes.
And we talked to other students who went to Wrangell Institute who wept about the sexual abuse that took place mm-hmm. at the institute,
yeah,
run by the federal government. So that's the sort of thing. But anyway, what we're told to do and what the tribe wants us to do now is take some of the chapters that we've written and adapt them to high school units so we can adapt the parts of the book for high school instruction. So we're working on that also. But our hope is that this becomes, well, another Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, an Alaskan version of history from a different perspective. And one of the interesting things we have found, we expected that the two versions of history would clash with each other. That is not true. That is not what we found. We found they tend to support each other. The indigenous version is kind of the rest of the story. They interweave. And so it's not a conflicting history. It's a more complete history. And that has been a very, very pleasant surprise.
That's
so
great.
Both sides are narrating the trauma of that experience as a
from
fact.
The perspective, from their but, perspective,
right,
yes.
Right.
And they don't necessarily conflict.
Right. You know, it's so important to talk about exactly what you were talking about at least children who are institutionalized, families who are torn apart, and how there's no modeled structure for how to be good parents or be good husbands or be good wives, or even to be good children for that matter, because it has an impact on them as well. And the importance of, as painful as it is, it allows the culture itself to face their own history from a truth perspective and understand themselves more in terms of why they are who they are and what they do, as opposed to constantly blaming it on themselves, for being just a natural broken people, and we don't know why. And so you're putting pieces together that clarifies that, you know,
yes,
that shows
exactly.
The history of why that happened. It's not that you came into the world broken, it's the systems have done that to you.
Yes.
Let's pause for a moment and listen to Rise Above the Storm, created and performed by West High School students from Anchorage, Alaska.
Passing scary feelings, the unknown, the courage is frosted eyes, nowhere to rest my tired soul. I feel burned out, what does life hold? I need a place to call my home.
We rise to fight injustice, we rise to fight oppression, we rise together, we rise together. We will rise above the struggle and continue to soar above the clouds. Eventually the fog will lift and we will rise above the storm.
I got pressure pushing me, it's immeasurable. Some cry for small things like they're unbearable. Terrified of what's coming, that's why I feel terrible. Remember the decisions you make, they're irreparable. You call it luck, but we call it a miracle. Can't keep on hating that life is unlivable. You need to shut it down, that hole is unfillable. The lessons learned on the journey are irreplaceable.
Family goes by, brightens each day. Sometimes life gets in the way, clouding our judgment. There's never a way. Home, a special place in my heart. Contentment, language, a thread where feelings never stray. The gateway to development.
We rise to fight injustice. We rise to fight oppression. We rise together. We rise together. We will rise above the struggle and continue to soar above the clouds. Eventually the fog will lift. And
a connection through words and voices, a bond between people, their cultural choices. Preserve the idea that brought us together. We don't want to forget our story that made us remember who we are, what we do, what we eat, what we speak, who we become, how we've changed. What does it even mean? I don't know what to do with these memories. Cherish histories, we are rising.
In the meadow, wildflowers sway, dancing gently in the sun's warm rays. A single can bloom, can light the way. Whether to the darkest days, the petals are soft and colors are bright.
This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest today is Paul Berg. Paul is sharing with us lessons from the war over education for Native youth in Alaska. This show may be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org.
Well, one of the phenomena that we have been able to document that is taking place today is some of the healing that's taking place. For example, Angoon. This past year, a Navy admiral and his staff, probably 14, 15 people, came in, and I believe it was Angoon. The village was destroyed by the Navy in the 1870s. They bombarded the village. There was a lot of death. The Navy came in and apologized. They didn't just come in and make a little speech. They stayed for like 24 hours. The ceremony lasted all night. The admiral, the Navy people were exemplary in their integrity and honesty and their wish to participate in the healing. The people of Angoon were very, were very, very appreciative and accepting. One of the things the admiral said was he was so amazed that There were tears that were shed, and he said, so many of the Tlingit people, to them, it was like the bombardment happened yesterday.
Yes.
And what he was commenting about is that the Tlingit have another sense of time. They have linear time. They function in linear time. They have watches just like the rest of us do, dominant culture time. But they have another sense of time called sacred time or cultural time. And cultural time, this event was yesterday.
Yes.
It was something you can cry about because it happened yesterday to you.
That's right.
And to your recent ancestors. And he was giving this legitimacy and commenting about how impressed he was and how important it was for the Navy and the naval personnel to honestly apologize and participate in the healing. And he felt honored, and so did the other naval personnel, to be able to help bring healing to this community. And it was a wonderful thing to be able to document in the book, because this is the sort of thing that can take place. Those of us who are not Native need to grab a hold of our brothers, our Native brothers and sisters, and assist them as they want to be assisted, not from our authoritative point of view, but as they wish to be assisted, we can help them and help the healing.
What did they describe?
Responsibility for what has happened. Not guilt, but responsibility.
Right. That's right. Very good.
Right. What did they describe as the healing? What did they describe as their experience? Because that's a word which has 1,000 meanings.
Well, the healing is part of what Peach has said. It's not on me anymore.
Uh-huh.
I'm not defective or because of my culture or the color of my skin or the language I'm speaking.
The fact you targeted
that
me.
Happen. And when the people from the dominant culture say there are things that happen that cause this, that helps for the healing. It legitimizes. It helps to legitimize the healing process. And for these people to say, we are here too. We will dance with you. Now, these are not like dancing in the Western world. It's dancing, a healing dance.
Yes.
We are here to help in the healing. We are here to cry with you. We are here to share the grief and to share the joy of healing with you.
Yes. You know, it's so important what you're saying, and it just resonates throughout everything that we do all the time, is to take responsibility for what we have caused, the harm we have caused other people, and to not quietly gaslight them or make them think that it was something wrong with them, because that's what we do. And we do that in personal relationships as well, that we will not admit that we actually did something, that it's only your imagination. It was just that you couldn't stand up enough. You weren't strong enough. It's a slew of things that put it back on you and blame you for how you dealt with it, rather than that we did something that no human being could deal with in a way that they are not broken. They cannot. Yes. And the admittance of those things are so important. You know, I found that in my life, I found that with children you adopt, with abused children, that saying that something actually happened to you, this is not because you are a broken human being that you came in the world defective. It is not that. And that is so important to actually healing. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well put.
Yeah, it's amazing work that you're doing.
So this healing process, as it is continuing, and I'm very glad to say the Army and the Navy are embracing this, because they are understanding. And what I have said to classes I've taught, largely non-Native people, this has nothing to do with guilt. Were you there? Did you do that? No, you didn't. This has nothing to do with guilt. This has to do with acknowledgement and acknowledgement of a cultural responsibility.
Very good.
And responsibility to assist and help with the healing today. We are all part of the solution. Every one of us.
That's right.
It's a joyful, joyful process.
Yeah. And I have to admit that you're telling that story about the apology and the ceremony and the healing from the Navy, did you say, is very impressive and actually made me feel like a slight bit hopeful that people can actually take responsibility for what they've done without worrying about how they're going to feel, if they're going to feel bad, and disregarding how the rest of the people that they harm feel. Because often that's what we do. Like, we don't want to approach that truth because we feel bad about it. Doesn't matter whether you feel bad about it. We don't want to approach it because we feel bad. And that, to me, is a big step up for people to stand up and apologize, especially when the military in general gets a horrible rap, you know, for who they are as people. And it's really impressive to hear that, you know.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. It is.
Let's take a break for Tundra Chant by Pamua. This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest today is Paul Berg. Paul is sharing with us lessons from the war over education for Native youth in Alaska. This show may be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org.
So, what, other questions?
Well, I'm going to stay with this a while longer. We have a really hard time wrapping our heads around this. But sometimes in war, we kill people we could respect.
Yes.
We don't have to demonize them to be at war with them. And in the act of demonizing them, it then makes it doubly hard to take responsibility for the killing that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are guilty not only of a violent death, deadly behavior, we're also guilty of dehumanization. And killing is not necessarily dehumanizing in a certain, in a very clear conflict way. It's just what is done.
The bottom line for me was saving other 18, 19, and 20-year-olds on the ground who are Americans. That was the bottom line. And as painful as everything was, you had to save fellow Americans. That's what I tried to do.
Right, right. And had you tried to do the other, you would have been insubordinate and traitorous.
Well,
you know, I mean, that's the way it is when you are a warrior in a war. And you try to save the enemy.
Personally, I dumped ordnance at times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that you're just telling us the choices that you have and make.
To avoid unnecessary killing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And save your boys.
Because the use of the ordnance would not have saved any Americans, and it may have killed civilians. And let's just get rid of it. And it was done collectively, not just by me.
No, no. But it is the side of the story that we also need to hear.
That's it, yeah. Absolutely. Also, you know, you are making me again realize that you're touching upon the issue of how when we kill in that way, that we are demonizing ourselves as well as we can be dehumanizing the person that gets killed from us. Yep. And we don't think about that, that we are also affected by killing. We are also affected by what we do, the blood on our hands. And so you're bringing that into focus, that it's not just the other person that's being dehumanized. If that's the case, it is, we are dehumanizing ourselves by stepping into that zone, you know?
Yes, yes, indeed. That.
And what we can do is to rehumanize ourselves, which is what it feels like you are absolutely doing in a very powerful way. Just the stories that you're telling and the things that you're willing to stand face to face with and toe to toe with, you know, is a very, very powerful way to rehumanize ourselves when we're doing the business of war. After we do the business of war, we to rehumanize yourself. And I love that, you know.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because for those of us from the Vietnam War, that was more difficult to do coming home. It was a very hostile environment, and I to come home to, you couldn't talk about what had happened or what you experienced. And I cannot in many ways blame the civilian population at the time, because it was an unjust war. It was very unpopular. And but it was a war where the participants were not seen as victims, but as the guilty party.
Right.
And I suppose there's truth on all sides of that, but it was a difficult time adjustment, as it is for all warriors coming back from any type of a conflict.
Yes.
Right.
Even the Sioux, I lived in the Sioux village for 5 years, and they are warrior group, and they had ways of dealing with what we would today call PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
From Sioux warriors, they had forms of treatment, if you will, because they suffered from the trauma of the Indian Wars.
But what you came back to after your time in Vietnam was a country where we did not collectively take responsibility for sending you there.
Yep.
And because we took no responsibility, we could tar you and claim to be lily pure on our side.
Absolutely.
And that kind of moral depravity, which it is depravity, sets up hatred, sets up violence, sets up isolation, sets up a sense of fake goodness, fake virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living the outcome of that now. The Democratic mm-hmm. Party has been overcome by that fakeness over 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I remember people throwing garbage on us in San Francisco. And I remember we didn't say they threw garbage on us. We said they threw garbage on our uniforms.
Yes.
There's a subtle difference there, but that's what bothered us the most, I think.
Yes.
It was.
Right, but it also protects you from being shamed by the sham of their garbage when you put it to the uniform rather than to you as a human being. It's a very, very thin line of protection.
Maybe. I never thought of that. But
well, that's the way I see it almost immediately, because you put it on the uniform and not allow them to get you. Because when you are being attacked every day and you can put it on the uniform, it's less painful than if you have to take it deep into your skin. But that doesn't stop what it is.
It was hurtful at the time, and thousands and thousands of Vietnam vets suffered from that.
Yes.
I know I lost my girlfriend over that. Well, just being gone so long.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Way
yes.
Around. That was very, very, very common. Still is today.
Yeah.
And also just the stories were hard for people to hear. Yours was not the generation that came back from World War II after having suffered the Depression.
No.
You know, we were in the boomingest economy we've ever known, and you were coming back into that after having been through some of the most literally explosive violence that we'd seen since then.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's almost like you come out of one war and come to a different kind of war against you, right, in this country.
Well, it was in a sense, and for me, that was a reality because I did go into a second war.
Yeah.
2.5 years after coming back.
Yes.
And at the Wounded Knee Uprising on the Pine Ridge Reservation. So one experience prepared me for the other.
Yeah.
It's much harder for me, but it would probably be much more powerful for me if I had been in those shoes in a uniform to say to people throwing garbage at me, oh, so you hate me. You don't know me. And you hate me. You don't know what I've done.
Me at the time, I kind of identified with the people throwing the garbage.
Yep.
Well, probably
so
right.
You've internalized it. Yep.
I probably deserve this.
Yeah. That is so hard.
Yeah.
That is so hard.
Yeah. And there was nothing telling you the opposite. There were no voices really telling you, not enough voices telling you the opposite, that in fact you did do this. You are the enemy to us. You are the person who, you know, engaged in an unjust, quote unquote, war. You know, that's.
Well, I was very fortunate at in that within several months, mm-hmm. I met Virginia, mm-hmm. whose father was a career army sergeant who had been a prisoner of war during World War II.
Yes.
Mother had been a prisoner also. And she was very affirming about military service and you're doing your duty to save and protect American soldiers on the ground. And so that was a wonderful and affirming experience. And
that's helpful. That's right.
We're in our 56th year now, and she's
right. And when you told that story, she recognized accurately your suffering as you looked at the magazine where the school was that you had directed the bombs to.
Yeah.
And she saw in you exact and recited it back to you as you told the story.
I did not pick that target. I merely had final approval.
Oh, I see.
Go because I did not identify it as a school. It had been identified by the photo experts as being the Vinh Regional Government Headquarters building. Yeah. And I didn't that it was not.
Yeah. Right.
So I did the final approval. I had my piece of that action.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. But that's what I mean about the business of war.
Right.
It's like you don't, you know, if someone said to you, oh, by the way, you're going to be bombing a school, you know, you might have to stop. Right. You know what I mean? Like, but that's
no,
not.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And the protesters, if we were honest as protesters, I have a really hard time with the simplicity that protesting tends to drive issues down to. But if we were honest, we would say this should not be happening, but we are still sending you there because you're going in our name. But most people who protest want to fan their ignorance as much as they want to fan their cause, because it's hard to have a mixed role in something that should not be happening.
Well, it's good to be very self-affirming and morally pure in it. When
I don't think so. I think it's one of the most evil things around.
Is what?
To perceive oneself of having to be morally pure.
Well,
it creates all sorts of lies.
I think it was.
No, I think that's. I think he's saying that. Like, I'm not. I don't think he's saying it's a good thing to do that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Right. It's,
right. You were saying it sarcastically, and I took it earnestly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Pardon me. I'm a Midwesterner through and through.
No,
I don't always get your sarcasm.
For the war protesters during the Vietnam era, it was very self-affirming for them because they felt very pure in their point of view. And in many ways, they were right. It was a war we were never going to win, and we probably didn't belong there. So the issues are very, very complex. And where I think they made a mistake is regarding the participants as the cause. You know, we were victims like anybody else, I
Right,
think.
right. And your protesting doesn't make you pure.
And
And
that's true.
that's what I just insist on.
And also that we really have to learn to think more in human in you know about the angles of human complexity instead of just casting this character on a person who goes to war and saying that's the end of it and not think like, I don't even know what kind of decision it took you to do that. I don't know what if it was con I don't know how you felt when you were there. Nobody asked those questions. Everybody's like, you were there, you're the bad guy, And when we do that, and we do that all the time in life, instead of and I'm not saying you try to understand so you could excuse people, but you try to understand so you have more information if you're going to levy kind of a judgment on something. You need all the information before you do that. And they did not have all the information, And in fact, they what they're doing in my mind, they were actually dehumanizing you and the people who went to war. Like all of a sudden, nothing mattered about who you were, what you felt, what you've gone through, what you believed, and nothing mattered,
But you know, from that experience, we, all of us, the American nation, learned some very basic lessons.
Yeah,
And one
good.
of them is today that the warrior is a victim of the war, not the cause.
Good.
And there's so much more concern and appreciation and regard for military veterans today than there was 55 years ago. And
Yes.
much more widespread in American society. And it's a lesson we have all learned, and it's been a positive step, and it's one of the things that it has improved in the United States over the past half century. And
Yes. And
I
I think that the demonstration of that respect of honoring people in those awkward roles is definitely improved. I have a less positive read of how clearly we've had conversations about what that means, how what that service was like and what the impact was on your life. Our doing these radio shows is in part to have bring those conversations more out to the fore because we still struggle. We don't dismiss people the way we did 55 years ago. We don't dismiss veterans or slam them, but we do not actually engage them in the moral complexity. And this
Right,
kind
because
of, go ahead.
you can take that same acceptance as a swing to the other side. So you're not necessarily seeing the complexity
Yes,
anymore.
that's right.
You just abandon the other role
That's
of
right.
you holding in victim. And that's one of the things I worry about. And I see people do that all the time. That in other words, they can't hold two concepts that are divergent in the same frame. And so that you're either like the good guy and the victim, or you're the bad guy and the enemy. And they don't see the blend. There are people, you're not every man. You didn't walk into that situation the same way everybody else did. So when you just put one kind of explanation around everybody, you're still not seeing human complexity,
Right. And
Even
this.
though I mean, I worked as a chaplain for veterans. So I've always been in that role of like, this is a complex, first of all, you start with this is a complex world, and we end up in situations where we don't even know they're going to be complicated, or they are, and we don't know how to what degree they're going. And so I don't go around just saying, oh yeah, you're the bad guy, you did this, you killed, you did this, any more than, I would be a vegan and say you're a bad guy because you eat meat. That's what we do. We swing from one pendulum to the next without really putting the two things together. And that is not as, that's no more honest than the other side of doing things.
Right. Let's pause for music with Peter, Paul, and Mary's Pack Up Your Sorrows. This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest today is Paul Berg. Paul is sharing with us lessons from the war over education for Native youth in Alaska. This show may be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org. Can I use this to take this little pivot point that we've come to about the complexity and holding on to it? How are you preparing teachers and students to kind of get this level, or is this part of, I mean, actually more, this is a quite better, are you helping teachers and students to get to this level of emotional and moral complexity when they learn about Alaskan history? Because that would seem to make for an incredible classroom experience where people are really talking about these different perspectives, these different damage that we've done and that's been done to us in this process. How are you addressing that as you try to prepare materials, resources for teaching?
Oh, well, yes, indeed. First of all, in the ethnography class that we're teaching this summer, our focus and even the focus of the National Indian Youth Conference, the Unity Conference in San Diego, is on youth voice and youth activism, young Native Americans becoming much more active in the social and political issues of the time in a positive way. And by going through parts of the history with the students in this course, that they may not be aware of, but teaching them also how to become socially active, social activists. Some of the strategies, for example, we've had two classes by Zoom already, and two of the main points I've been sharing with them is, number one, collect the data to understand the issue. Collect the data and the facts. Do research. Be accurate. Make sure you got accurate data and accurate facts if you want to understand the issue. And before you try to convince anybody else to agree with you, make sure you're accurate. Another thing is, the second one was, you can lead from below. You don't have to have a high position. In fact, real change in the United States comes up from the people. It doesn't come from the leaders on down. It bubbles up from the bottom. So lead from below. We can all lead from below by competence, by accuracy, by credibility. And this is positive leadership. And incidentally, one of the other principles I will be teaching them along the line is that when you're working with politicians and you're working on an issue, and let's say you only get 5% of what you wanted, celebrate that 5% and give all the credit to the politicians. Give all the credit. Why? Because they're going to like working with you. Wow, these people are cool. They give me credit for what I did, and I didn't do that much, but you build good rapport and you make it positive, and you use a sense of humor and a sense of positivity. But I've seen people, and I've worked with organizations that do this, and they have more success by being accurate, being positive, leading from below, and giving credit to the people who feel they need it. It's okay. You're kind of feeding an ego, but it works. It works. Things like that. Yes, yeah. Indeed. We will be doing that. In terms of the education system in rural Alaska, about 10 or 12 years ago, I continued working to strengthen it. No more. I want to see it done away with and replaced with a native-based education system. And that is indeed what the politicians in Alaska are looking at doing today. They are very receptive to this at this point. The education system itself and the educators and the Department of Education and the bureaucrats, no, they are absolutely resistant. But the politicians are a step ahead of them. They are listening. They are saying, this system has failed. We need to do something different. Mm. So it's a dynamic situation, and this is what we need, the voices of the young people who are just getting out of high school, entering college, because the solutions will come from them. They will be the ones that bring about the big change. Does that kind of answer your question a little bit?
Well, I mean, it does in terms of a kind of a tactical approach to these things. Yes. I was looking, but I'm looking also for the dealing with some of this moral complexity where, you know, where I am. I'm adopting a voice here. I'm playing a character. I come from six generations of people who were not raised in a home and six generations of parents who've had children, but who haven't known how to parent them. I want to be a parent, and I have a tremendous human skills in human relationships, but I don't have a lot of background. How do we respect the traditions and the touchstones that I have some access to, but the lack of respect or lack of a legacy that I can easily tie into? I mean, I look at my nephew, and these are, now I'm switching to my own voice. I look at my nephews and nieces and my great nephews and great nieces who've largely been raised in a American public school system, most of them in predominantly white schools, where they are no better off than had they been in boarding schools because of the rampant comparison, the rampant disconnection from school, from and the either abuse by authority or abusing authority from below, that it's tolerated. It's just a free-for-all in many, many ways. And so I don't see them as any better, and how to talk about what they would want is complicated. It's morally tough.
Well, I can't address your situation, but I can from four and a half decades of being involved with Alaskan rural.
That's what I'm asking, yes.
Address that situation.
Yes.
First of all, in rural Alaska, the cost per child per year is from $40,000 to $50,000 per year per child for education. It is extremely high cost, one of the most expensive education systems in the world. Now, the outcome of that extremely expensive education system is one of the worst outcomes in the world. The Yupik and Inupiaq male suicide rate is a hemispheric record. Dropout rate, disease, we mentioned suicide, alcoholism. The result, it's toxic what is happening. So you've got this extremely expensive education system producing a disaster. So what needs to be done? Well, let's look at models around the world. What's been done in Greenland, what the Canadians did at Nunavut, what the Norwegians did with the Sami in Norway. They turned the education system over to them.
Right.
They will make the decisions what they need to include in their curriculum, in their languages they teach, in the courses they teach. And maybe it will be parenting, but they have to make the decisions themselves, what will be taught. They will address those issues and be far more accurate than the state school board setting the standards to be evaluated by standardized tests that are standardized in Iowa or Michigan. And that is what we're struggling for, aiming for, and more the politicians in Alaska are opening their eyes to this and saying, yes, we need to turn the education system over to the people. Every culture in every indigenous people living in their homelands have the right to perpetuate their culture, language, and way of life through education. When we take that away from them, it's a form of colonialistic education. When we bring in teachers from the outside to teach them to be like us, it's colonialistic education. It's also a form of cultural genocide, and it produces casualties, as in Alaska today, very high death rate. It's like having a garden where your plants are wilting. You've got a toxin in there. You've got a poison, or you're not giving them enough water, because the school is like a garden. If the kids are coming out of the schools and they're damaged, something is basically wrong. And that's the message that Virgie, my wife, and I are being paid by the Tlingit tribe and other Native organizations to write about and present and say. And the reason is non-Natives were employed to do that is we've been up there so long and have worked so long and have the credibility and can speak to the non-Native community with authority, and they listen.
Right. And so, yeah, no, I'm really glad that you took it away from my focus on the schools, because you have basically given up on reforming schools and you've got to reinvent the schools. And I get that. And that this is your work from an Alaskan Indigenous people's perspective allows that to begin.
I mean, now in Alaska, probably in June, the state of Alaska will be bringing over a bunch of teachers from the Philippines. Now they have college degrees and they have certification that's recognized by American institutions. They can't get enough dominant culture teachers to go up in these villages where these problems are happening. So they're importing them from a foreign country. nothing to say anything bad about these Filipino teachers. Filipino, the Philippines exports expertise around the world. They export nurses and doctors. They're a very important part of American medical hospitals today. They're exporting engineers now around the world. It's the Filipino diaspora. But now even teachers to native villages in the United States, this is madness. This is crazy. But they have, culturally, they're acceptable because they have degrees from four-year colleges that are recognized by American institutions. They're not bad people, they're good people, but it just isn't, it's a form of madness. It's cult, it's colonialistic education that's just going out of control. So we point these things out and kind of make fun of it a little bit.
Yes.
Let's take a break with Phil Oakes' I Ain't Marching Anymore.
To the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't a marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I anymore.
This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest today is Paul Berg. Paul is sharing with us lessons from the war over education for Native youth in Alaska. This show may be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org.
I could add that one of the interesting parts of this is frequently when I'm talking with Native parents, Native educators, they give me so much encouragement. Paul, keep doing what you're doing. You've got to say this even louder. Say it more. Write about it more. Keep doing it. And they will refer to, why last year, so-and-so in our village, he was 16 years old and he killed himself. He just felt he was the wrong type of human being. He felt he had no future. And they'll talk about it. Frequently, I will talk with non-Native educators, and they'll say, well, yes, we realize these are things that are happening, but that has nothing to do with education. We're doing good things for these people. We're bringing in good courses, and we're bringing in good teachers. We're doing really good things for these people. What I find is that the non-Native educators very frequently dissociate. They dissociate. Dissociation is where you lose the connection between cause and effect. This cause causes this effect. Non-native teachers tend to, the institution teaches them to dissociate. Dissociation is a form, is an aspect of mental disease. Schizophrenics dissociate.
But so do survivors from combat or from violence.
Yes. It's a
survival mechanism.
Surviving a very unpleasant situation, dissociation. I once talked with a principal, this was some years ago. He was his second year in a village. Typically, they will stay 2 or 3 years, and then they're gone, back to the lower 48. And he had, in about an 18-month period, there had been 3 young people in the village that had died, one from disease, one from suicide, and the other from a strange accident, like running a 4-wheeler off a cliff or something. I can't remember the exact disease. And I said to him, does this have anything to do with your education program? Oh, no. Oh, heavens, no. This has nothing to do. No, we are providing good classes. We're really doing, boy, look what we did last year. He could see no relationship between the bizarre death rate of the young people in the village, where there were fairly large village. There were 60, 70 kids in the school, but that was a extremely high death rate. And no relationship whatsoever. And that was classical dissociation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like part of the disease in the bush today is non-indigenous dissociation.
Yeah, and I think that the type of dissociation you're talking about is the type of dissociation that is not just temporary under the circumstances.
Right, right, right.
You know, that's one of the differences, that this kind of dissociation is just kind of embedded in the attitude that either we're superior to your type, we are not at fault for anything that happens, even though we are part of the structure of the school system. And that's a very different type of dissociation from the kids. When you were talking earlier about teachers, I kept thinking about there are two different things. One, that when you come from a marginalized person, a marginalized group of people, you have an instinct to look for your people. Right. So when your teachers are not necessarily your people or representative enough or passionate enough like you are connected to those people, you lose something in the connection to begin with, you know, and so that needs to be addressed in the first place, you know.
Absolutely. One of the essentials for education to take place is to have a shared background knowledge.
Thank you. Yes.
A teacher comes in to the village, does not know the language, does
right.
not know the history,
right?
Not know the learning style of the kids, does not know the culture. I mean, there are thousands of cultural rules in
yes.
new culture, and does not know the skills the kids need to live either in the rainforest, the
yeah.
tundra, or the Arctic. They have no shared background knowledge.
Yes.
And real education does not take place. You know, and a person's background knowledge is accumulation of their wisdom and experience. And they come from two different worlds, like these Filipino teachers who are going to come into the bush for this 2025 to 2026 school year. They're going through a 2-week orientation in Alaska, and then they'll be sent to these villages. They will not connect, and it doesn't work very well, but they'll train them for taking tests and standardized tests, which is the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's absurd. It does not work. It's failing. And the interesting thing is, when Alaska does turn over the education system to the native people, which inevitably has to happen, it'll be a much cheaper system to run than it is today. It'll be more efficient. Alaska will save a lot of money.
Okay. Yeah, I worry about the lack of, also the lack of, you know, your history or people's history that you're part of designs, it lays out the blueprint to who you are. And when you don't know the history, even the big pieces and certainly the nuanced pieces of a people, then you cannot connect in the way that you think you can. You know, what you're doing is actually trying to change them to something that they are not. Mm-hmm. Or trying to understand them through a lens that is cloudy, you know.
The education system should reinforce the child's identity. The number one role of it, I was a teacher for 45 years. The number one role of a teacher is to affirm the existence and the identity of another human being. That's the number one role. It's so basic, it's unstated for most educators. It's just an unconscious given. When you have a colonialistic education system, you're not doing that.
Nope.
You're not performing the most fundamental. You're trying to change the identity and make them into somebody else.
That's exactly right. That's right.
And it doesn't work. It fails ultimately.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
And like you said before, we will not connect it back to what we're doing in the schools. We won't connect it. You know.
But there is, in the Western mental mindset, and I'm not saying Caucasian or white. I'm saying Western cultural.
Absolutely.
Because it's not a racial thing necessarily. It's a cultural thing.
Yes.
In the dominant culture, there is a sense of arrogance and superiority.
Yes.
We're the ones who will teach you how to be, well, to be American, too.
Absolutely. It's like the same concept of civilizing the natives. It's the same concept.
Yes, we will bring civilization to them. We'll teach them how to live in this modern economy and get loans and mortgages on their houses and
right.
Car payments in your village with maybe a half mile of road, but you need a car because that's what Americans have. You can get a pickup for your half mile. Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen. Pickups bought into villages for the half mile of road because it's the thing to do.
Right.
Yeah.
But no, it's a cultural arrogance that has been around for 500 years.
Oh God,
and
yes.
We're learning, but interestingly enough, it is the Army and the Navy that has, in the last several years, taken the lead in really doing some wonderful things. I'm so proud of that. I'm just proud of the Navy and the Army for saying it doesn't hurt us to apologize, and it doesn't hurt us to participate in the healing ceremony, which may take 24 hours. Because it's very intense and it goes all night, and making a few healing speeches and performing the healing dances with the people, and sometimes listening to the tears and even hugging because people are so grateful. And so that's happening. I see a parallel with Vietnam vets who've gone back to Vietnam and met with some of the North Vietnamese NVA and Viet Cong veterans. And they weep together and sometimes cry together. And they heal each other.
Yes.
They heal each other. And that's probably some of the most honest communication on Earth today. Anyway, that's...
Right. How can you... what are the steps that are really going to have to be taken for Indigenous groups to take over the education? And then at what point does this kind of healing become an option? Because there's been a lot of damage.
No, I can tell you exactly. About 4 or 5 years ago, the governor, and I can't remember his name, recognized the system is failing completely. We've got to do something. He put together a group of 100 Alaska citizens, and they brought them together for a week. And I believe it was a week long. And they said, come up with 5 suggestions. What do we do? Alaska's in a crisis. We got this. We got the highest indigenous incarceration rate in the world as of 2012. Mm-hmm. We've got the suicide rate, the murder rate. What do? Give me five suggestions. They spent a week. They came up with five suggestions. The most powerful one, and the governor and the legislature decided we're going to do this. This is, they said, turn over rural education to the native people. Shut down the current system. Governor proposed this, and the legislature said, let's do it. So the decision, in that sense, has been made. Then along came COVID for 2.5 years, disrupted the program completely. So what they've done is, I'm giving you a, this is part of the book we're writing. We did an analysis. We're not just reporting history. We are descriptive, but we're also prescriptive and analytical.
Very good.
Because we're not writing just a Western history, objective history. We're basing it on our experience and indigenous experience and indigenous guidance, because it's an indigenous sponsored book. And what we've done in our analysis in the last chapter is what the state has decided to do, and they did it this year, this last school year. They said we're going to follow a model in Southwest United States and also in Washington State. We're going to compact the schools. Compacting is a form of contract. There are 223 Native organizations in Alaska. We'll recognize all of them as tribal organizations, and they can compact for a school, okay? And they can run the school. That will include the curriculum, the lessons, what language or languages are used, who does the teaching. In other words, they can make their own certification requirements. They can set up their own training program and their where it's held and the schedule. In other words, that is full control. So this year they set up five different sites to try it out. Now the problem is, whereas the bureaucrats, no, the politicians have made the decision, we've got to turn over the system to the native people. It goes through a bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy, in our judgment, in my judgment, is hell-bent determined this is not going to happen. The problem being, you have all these different native groups competing for the funding to get one or two sites. If you have one or two sites, you do not have the size or scale or the bureaucracy to, number one, create a curriculum, create lessons, create a training program for your staff, create an internal culture and a support system for a cultural support system for your schools. They become just independent little schools, and the fighting will be over the funding and the jobs. And the model for that is in the lower 48 Southwest. It doesn't work well. I've talked with the Commissioner of Education, and she says, this process, we're fully in control. We know what's happening. We're going to make it happen. It'll take 10 years, and we'll do it gradually. And, of course, I say you don't have 10 years.
Yes.
The time has long passed for incremental change.
Right.
It will not work. It will fail. Mm-hmm. They will retain control. What needs to be done, for example, is the Yupik region, where the Yupik, 32,000 Yupik live. They have six school districts there now, six administrative centers, six superintendents of schools, six school boards, six or several dozen assistant superintendents, all kinds of administration. It's extremely expensive and inefficient to run. With modern technology, we need one administrative center for the whole Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, a region the size of Oregon. This is really big. But if you set up a system that big, you can have bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is not bad. Bureaucracy is a way you can develop a training system. You can develop standards. You can develop certification. You can develop curriculum, whereas individual or two schools together can't do that. It just can't develop quality. Then we need to, we would set up a North Slope, Inupiaq, cultural educational region, or set up a Dena along the Copper River, educational region, Southern Alaska, Tsimshian region, not just one or two schools. You have to do it in size, but they're not approaching it that way because the system still wants to retain control. The way they're setting it up, 50 years ago when I came up to Alaska, they were setting up the REAAs, Rural Educational Attendance Areas. They shut down the state operating system because it was in a state of failure. Now we're going to bring education to the villages, and we're going to let the village people set up their own education system. Within 3 or 4 years, the REAAs had simply morphed into school districts that were run like school districts in the lower 48. Same certification standards, non-native superintendents, school boards, Iowa test of basic skills sort of thing, and teachers coming from the lower 48 and administrators. This is the system that has failed, and we're shutting down. It's the legislature has made the decision to shut down. But we're going to, right now, the way they're setting it up, we're going to repeat the mistakes again and set up another dysfunctional system. That's what we see happening, and that's what we're saying. It works, but it has to be done on a very large scale.
Let's pause for music now with Letters from War by Mark Schultz.
To the mailbox on that bright summer's day, found a letter from her son in a war far away. He spoke of the weather and good friends that he'd made. Said, "I've been thinking about she'll not forget, or tears stained the paper with every word. Captain, where her boy used to stand, he
This is the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. Our guest today is Paul Berg. Paul is sharing with us lessons from the war over education for Native youth in Alaska. This show may be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org. The problem you're describing is kind of like the song or the rhetoric, you know, the old king is dead, long live the new king, because the new king will become the old king in a short time. And our temptation is to do exactly what you're saying, to think bigger. But one of the thing about your stories about your military experience was maybe thinking smaller and thinking, how do we deal with these interactions that people need to have to learn? How can you think smaller in the ways that the people can actually address the problems without just seeking a solution that's been tried and failed elsewhere before, so they actually stay with each other long enough to create the systems that you're interested in?
Well, to answer your question, first of all, we have to look at models around the world that have worked. The models that have worked, like Nunavut in Canada, is a large-scale model. The models that have worked, like Greenland.
What makes that model work? Because I'll be clear up front. I have found almost no model replication to ever work, because it replicates the worst of the model rather than the people relationships. So help me understand how that model has done a better effort at working with the relationships, the complexity of the Sami relationships or the other, or the Nunavut or whatever.
Well, again, I repeat that when you have that larger scale, you can develop a curriculum that is a Yupik curriculum or a Sami curriculum with that takes a lot of work. Individual schools cannot do that. They don't have the scale. Secondly, you can develop a training program for your own certification standards, because the certification will be taken away from the state. And they're saying individual schools are going to certify their own teachers. They can't train them. They don't have the scale. But a larger system can do it.
I know all those arguments, and I've heard them many, many times before. And I know that there is some truth to them. I also know that they hide. A lot of schools could identify the people in their community who can teach, whether they have the credentials or not, and they can hold them accountable to teaching. That's a real risky thing to do, but you can have two methods functioning at the same time, trying to create the more centralized, larger scale thing at the same time as you have a great deal of respect for people who have wisdom on the go, on the ground. I mean, that's just it's a question that I've just born from my own experience. Because the relying on scale to fix things oftentimes just kicks the can down the road.
Well, I don't know what to say to this, that individual schools are going to maintain and develop their own curriculum. They can't.
No, they can't by themselves, but they have to have an incentive and the resources to work with others and not be told to organize from the top down. I do agree that this kind of integration, collaboration can emerge.
The model that has been done in the past is to subdivide and control. You get the individual Native groups competing with each other for grants and keep it them subdivided into small organizational patterns, and you control it. That is the pattern that's used, divide and conquer.
It doesn't work.
And it works very effectively for the dominant culture.
For control.
But when you turn over the system and let the indigenous people organize it in a larger scale, it develops the power to do this sort of thing. Bear in mind, the REAAs were developed into the massive system that we're shutting down right now, because it was very effective at providing employment for non-Native people. Right. The Native people of Alaska became an industry of the middle class, and they still are to this day. It's an industry that is destroying them.
Right.
And the state has come to the conclusion it has to be completely changed. The other part of it is the United Nations 2007 resolution, Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, which states that Articles 13 and 14, that Native people have the right to control their own education system and have complete political control of the system. And their choice would be to have a much larger system than little bits and pieces being handed out.
Right. And it's not an either or. I'm not presenting it that way at all. But if every child and family with every child of every child has $40,000 to contribute to the per child to contribute to the education, they can say with some impact, we're going to do these things locally. We have to work together, but the money isn't fought after for grants where you end up controlling everybody from the center. You know, there needs to be ways that this, and what I'm not hearing are the subtle ways that allow for conflicts to be productive at scale rather than controlling at scale. What was tried in the past put communities competing with each other, which just gave the power over to the dominant culture. How do you have conflicts that keep local and larger scale things going at the same time? I think that can be done.
We need to back away and ask the Native community, how do you want this organized?
That's exactly right. And what kinds of conflicts are meaningful to you? Because you know,
want to have to compete with each other every year over small scale grants.
They don't want to do that. I used to chair the grants committee here at the Community Foundation, and we saw small nonprofits just tear themselves up for $5,000 or $10,000. It takes a lot of time, and all it ended up being was a time to showcase your organization in the public eye if you got this grant, because it wasn't enough money to do anything, to really do anything. And this is the way elites control small grassroots groups.
There's another aspect to this, and that is that cultures are indeed living entities. They're collective living entities. And the harsh reality is that one culture will consciously make a decision to kill another. That is not to say that the individuals within that dominant culture have a decision themselves that they're going to be part of a killing process. They may be totally unaware. They may rationalize it. They may dissociate. But the culture itself, which is a multi-generational entity, has made the decision to kill the subordinate culture. That has happened in Alaska. The dominant culture is retaining the devices to still...
I have no doubt of that whatsoever.
The dominant culture, by keeping them subdivided, competing and fighting with each other over the shreds of resources that they will hand out, so you can take over individual schools without giving them actual power over the complete education system. And that's what we are pointing out in the book. Now, I have not had this run through the elders yet. I don't know if they'll accept my analysis. Yeah. I suspect they will, because they recognize this, but it'll be a few more months before my analysis runs through the power system in the Douglas Indian Association.
Right, and they have their own approach to conflict, and almost all cultures do, and just being relatively transparent about it allows it to be productive, unless they're hiding among their own people.
Set up an overall board for the whole thing, or they may set up a board with an elders board to advise. I mean, they may come up with a different structure, but they will, I'm pretty sure, recognize the need for scale, because otherwise people are just going to.
I'm not denying the need for scale. I'm just saying you can't play locality off against scale. They cannot be played. They have to be moved forward together at the same time.
Again, in Norway, the Sami education system is nationwide.
Yeah.
And what the Canadians did in Nunavut. Interestingly, when Greenland, about 25 years ago, when the Danes, and I mentioned this last time we talked, when they turned over the education system to the indigenous people of Greenland, they were very rational about it. They said to the first kindergarten, first, second, and third grade Danish teachers, "Thank you very much for your service. You may now go back to Denmark." And they said to the aides, you are now the teachers, because they wanted, especially the first few grades, to be in the indigenous language. From there on out, the selection of curriculum and teachers was much more just it depended on the situation
Ad
and the
hoc.
community. And for the high school levels, they kept 80 or 90% of the Danish teachers. They were specialists, and it was actually very rationally handled, very well handled. They just went from their own set of priorities. They wanted to retain Danish, very, very clearly Danish citizenship, part of the Danish nation. They have not requested independence. They're semi-independent, and it may change in the future. But in Norway too, the Norwegian, the Sami are loyal Norwegian citizens. The schools are run in Sami and Norwegian, and very bicultural, bilingual.
Teaches what you've been trying to get in here. I understand.
It's okay. I'm just,
You're
I'm
taking it in.
listening, and I feel like the conversation, there are a lot of things that are just the same across the board, but there are also a lot of things that are very different that we can't take the same peg and fit in the same hole. We're talking at a whole different, we have a world that often just doesn't work. But my attitude is that, whenever someone, especially on the scale to me that you're operating on in the teaching world, is trying to positively make a difference, especially dealing with the population of people that you're dealing with, which are not American, which are not, they have a whole different world, like you said, that it seems like it's worth the try, even with the things that might be the same, that at least someone's trying to do something to change this dominant structure that leads back to the same hole.
Or
And you'll
has.
see. And sometimes you just have to see. You know what I mean? You never know what you might come along. Also, you like you said, like everything's not approved right now. Everything's not in place right now. You kind of take a project and you work toward it, like we all do really in life. And you kind of cross bridges as you get to them, and hopefully you do it more rationally and, without repeating the same mistakes that other people have repeated. But it is a very, I mean, listening to the statistics that you talk about, and I worked in education for 50 years, and it is, even here, it's sad to me, that I'm happy to hear somebody who have some angle. I don't hear many people talking really anymore. They're just kind of abandoning ship in a lot of ways, whether they do it emotionally or physically. They just kind of abandon ship. And the children are definitely abandoning ship. There's no question about that. Either they're not going, they're killing themselves, they're, it's a mess, really.
Indeed. Yes, indeed.
And
And
it's very frightening. It really is.
but I'm optimistic in the sense that there are solutions. We can turn this around, and we can turn it around in Alaska if we're willing to make the transformational changes and let go and give the people the opportunity to run their own education system, and not be in charge and telling them how to do it, that they must do it according to our frame of reference to the world. The other part of this is that in the indigenous languages and the indigenous knowledge base, there is knowledge that is not in Western science or the Western knowledge base. There's
You're
knowledge
right.
about the Arctic and the subarctic, and I mean real, real knowledge that the Yupik and the Inupiaq have an understanding of ice and glacier and Arctic conditions that Western science does not understand. And we have much to learn from these cultures and from their ability to teach us, but we're not very open to it because we arrogantly think that we know better and have to tell them how to run their systems, how to even run their education.
Right. And you were saying about their cultural time versus linear time. Now, that's a lesson that the West has lost. We did have a notion of time that wasn't linear. I grew up with it, but most people had lost it long centuries ago. But it was, what is this eternal time? where what happened 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago was yesterday, or maybe tomorrow, because it happens again. And we can learn a lot from each other. I was just getting somewhat defensive about give it to them to control. Who is them? A village? A national unit? Them matters. And it's not because I want to control them. I want to know what their agency is, what we're really honoring as the them that has an agency. Because I agree with you completely that we need to honor that independent agency for working out their future at scale
right now,
that works.
Them is a 501c organization or that's native, or a recognized tribal entity like Douglas Indian Association, right, that we work for. It has to be recognized by the dominant culture as an organization. What I am referring to is the native organization are the cultural, like, it's more or less defined by a geographic region where mm-hmm. certain people with a linguistic and cultural affiliation or similarity live in that area, like the YK Delta, which is mostly Yupik, although there could be two or three different dialects of Yupik in the region. But that would be native organization that I
and
would
they
say.
Would sort out that conflict or that
they,
separation.
They would sort that out themselves. Absolutely. And find the organizational structure themselves. But we're not letting them do it at this point. We are saying, no, there's 223 organizations, and only those can apply for funding. Yeah. Well, that's dominant culture control
right.
again.
That's what I suspected.
Divide and conquer. They're fighting among themselves for the resources. Yeah. And this is the technique that's been used for years and years and years.
Yes.
I'm afraid if we continue doing this in Alaska, we run the risk of normalizing the crisis and just sending it
yep.
into the
future. Yep. No, I hear you completely.
Good way to put it. Yeah.
Yep. Paul, anything, any closing comment you want here?
Oh, well, no. Yes, I suppose. No, I think of this as a cultural war. Mm-hmm. It's any success Virgie and I have had has been due to military experience. It's been the positive experience of working in naval intelligence, targeting foreign air group during the Vietnam War, and then working with the FBI and federal marshals and the American Indian Movement during the siege of Wounded Knee and the 5 years afterwards, working to stabilize the children from the village, a village that had 10,000 rounds fired into it on a daily basis for weeks on end.
Yeah.
And these kids were very, very highly traumatized. And what can be done to repair the trauma? It can be done. We can win in Alaska, and we should be able to turn this around, hopefully. I'm hopeful.
Yeah.
But I'm, again, grateful for the military experience. For
yes.
the Navy and even the relatively bad times during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these kinds of conversations and arguments that we were having, we're not looking towards such different things, but we approach the conversation differently.
And we're talking about two different worlds in a lot of ways. We really are. Yeah. I mean, I feel that way even in this country as a Black person, that sometimes I'm having completely different conversations with a human being.
Right, right. Yeah, and so I'm not having the dominant culture conversation.
Like, yeah.
You know, that's not me. That's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
But I think of the thought, sometimes in American mainstream education, and I could point to a dozen instances of this, but sometimes we get it dead wrong, absolutely dead mm-hmm. wrong. One of them has to do with 55 years ago when I started as a young teacher in a multicultural situation. The literature said, and the experts said, there's language interference. Don't avoid the native language because it interferes with them learning English. When my wife came to this country, she spoke fluently three languages. She was conversational in two more, and she was learning a sixth. Her family was so multilingual, was incredibly right. multilingual.
Right.
Her parents were told in the American school, she was 12 years old, only speak English to your children because the other languages will interfere. She actually cries about it sometimes these days. She was so multilingual, she lost it all because the educators said there was this thing called language interference. Now we know that multilingualism is an incredible intellectual and psychological advantage to a human being. We know that knowing the native language is incredible psychological and cultural and identifiable advantage. But the educators, and we were told, no, it interferes. It's language interference.
Yeah. No.
Even, so you know, really, when you think about other cultures, certainly like that, even the background of the history of the spiritualism and the rituals and the rites of passages, all of that changes absolutely the way we think in this world. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, thank you, Paul. Thanks.
This was fun. Thank you very much.
Good. I'm glad we had a good time.
Someone of value to share. Thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you for the work you're doing, really.
Right. May the transformation be not too far away.
Well said. Well said. Thank you.
This has been the Made of Clay Report with Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay. This show with Paul Berg can be found in its entirety at madeofclay.org. Let's close today's show with Teach Your Children by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
Are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. Your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.